when you look through the journey of C.S. Lewis as he's moving toward Christianity, some of the major figures that help him to move toward that are, in fact, Plato and Aristotle and some of the other writers who developed Plato and Aristotle.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the producer of the show. For this episode, I'm repeating an interview first released in 2013 that was with Dr. Adam Barkman about his book C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life. Dr. Barkman is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Redeemer College University in Ontario, Canada. His book is a complete look at the philosophical development of Lewis and the various views he held within specific areas of philosophy. Although I just made reference to where you teach, tell us first about your background to help the listener understand your qualifications for writing this book and more about what you currently do.
Well, I did my master's degree in English literature, and when I was doing that, I was quite interested in the works of C.S. Lewis, especially as a literary critic. But as I got more and more into Lewis, I was slowly kind of attracted to some of the philosophical underpinnings of his own work. And so when I finished my master's degree at the University of Toronto, I actually switched to do a PhD in philosophy at the Free University of Amsterdam. And I wrote my dissertation there on C.S. Lewis and philosophy. And actually the first half of my book, so the first 250 pages, are some of the same material that would be in that same dissertation. And I even taught a class on C.S. Lewis and philosophy as a way of life, where we looked at sources that Lewis used to develop his own philosophy, some very obscure ones that are not read nowadays. You know, lots of time reading about Lewis and philosophy and his sources helped me to kind of get to the point where I could write about this book.
In the introduction of C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life, you begin with an interesting story that addresses a common objection many people have who don't know Lewis's background very well. In other words, why would you write a book about him and philosophy when he wasn't a philosopher?
Well, two things need to be clarified. It depends what we mean by philosophy. The title of my book is C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life. And if we take philosophy in its broadest sense, then philosophy is simply thinking hard. And if we think of philosophy as a way of life, then it's thinking hard and trying to apply the things that we've developed to our daily lives, to living it out. And that was the ancient Greek conception of philosophy, and one that I think Lewis himself embraced. So in those both of senses, Lewis certainly was a philosopher, but he also taught philosophy at Oxford. He also had a degree in philosophy from Oxford, and that was the first thing that he actually began teaching when he was there. So he was, as a man, he was a philosopher, and as a Christian, he was a philosopher, and as an academic, he was also, in fact, a philosopher. And so it made quite good sense to me that we explore this a bit more, especially see how he's more than an apologist, where he's most famously known for.
You already noted the expression as a way of life, or philosophy as a way of life, but wonder if you would give maybe some more points about what that phrase means and how does it add to your defense of Lewis as a philosopher?
Well, the phrase actually comes from a dialogue that we get between, that Lewis recounts, I think it's Surprised by Joy, where he was one day, this is before he converts to theism, Lewis is talking to Barfield and Griffith, and one day Lewis casually refers to philosophy as a subject, and Barfield, Lewis notes quite correctly, corrects him on this and says, wasn't a subject to Plato, it was a way. And Barfield wasn't making up something new here. According to Pierre Hadot, who is one of the great experts of ancient philosophy, he says that for the ancients, philosophy was a choice that was made in a particular cultural context, follow a certain group of people who had a certain take on life, which demanded training, both physical and mental and otherwise, that ultimately resulted in some sort of rational discourse, a way of framing the world and understanding it, and that needed to be practiced. For Plato, again, you didn't know anything until you practiced it, and that was the emphasis on for ancient philosophy. To know it would be to want to live it. And Lewis acknowledges as he works through his own philosophy arguments for Christianity. Those were all in place by the time he's about to convert. Rather, he says, my problem is faith. I don't have that thumos, that energy, that emotional spur to kind of move me toward ultimately embracing what I know to be right. But as we know, he does, and he becomes quite famous for being a passionate Christian, and in fact, a passionate Christian philosopher, I'd say.
On a lighter note, you made reference to your thesis, but what was the process involved in writing this book, and how long, per se, did it take?
Well, this book was a tremendously long project. It started with my first years doing my PhD, and I wrote some papers there that I got published. These ideas were already starting to help me develop certain themes or chapters or sub-points in the book. There was a dialogue, for example, I had in Christian Scholars Review with Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen about C.S. Lewis and gender, and that helped me to get deeper into a lot of Lewis's works, kind of cover across the board from his letters to his essays to his books, to try to fill out what he thought about X, you know, gender, masculinity, or femininity, for example, but also how he developed this over time. And so that was one of the things I started doing early on, and that started to culminate with more papers on other various philosophical subjects, and it culminated with a thesis, and from the thesis, I just kept on developing that further to talk about different themes in Lewis, for example, how Lewis developed specifically metaphysically, or how Lewis developed specifically epistemologically, and so on. And so it took about 6 to 7 years to actually complete the book.
Well, in your book, you state that Lewis's mature thought would be classified as Neoplatonic Christianity. Describe some of what you mean by that and why you say this would be his position.
Yeah, sometimes it's called Christian Platonism or Platonic Christianity. My phrasing there, where we talk about Neoplatonic Christianity, I make the Neoplatonic the adjective because I think it's the lesser thing, describing the greater thing, the noun, Christianity. Neoplatonic refers to this sort of movement to synchronize the best in Plato, Aristotle, the ancient Greeks, Stoics, for example, even the pagan religion. That was what the Neoplatonists were all about. And Lewis, of course, he acknowledges his debt to Plato and Aristotle. He says, it'd be like cutting off my hands. And, of course, Lewis loved Greek mythology and Norse mythology, and he quite shamelessly delighted in all of these myths and stories. And he brought them into Christianity in a way that that I think Christians hadn't seen for a long time, at least. And part of the reason that we delight in Narnia, for example, is precisely that he finds place within Christianity to, in some measure, baptize these other influences. And, when you look through the journey of C.S. Lewis, as he's moving toward Christianity, some of the major figures that help him to move toward that are, in fact, Plato and Aristotle, and some of the other writers who developed Plato and Aristotle, especially the Christian ones like Boethius and Augustine and Dante.
You just made reference to Narnia. My next question was going to deal with part of that, and that is you actually use some of Lewis's fictional work to find his philosophical views, but point out that this is not often a good place to discover a writer's philosophical views. Why is this, and then why is this an exception for Lewis?
Well, Lewis, this is where I'm quite Lewisian. Lewis had his exchange, which is published as The Personal Heresy. And in that, Lewis notes that we can't assume that all the things written in a text or presented on stage, I suppose, or otherwise, not all the different views expressed in a work of art necessarily express the view of the author or the creator. And, you know, we could well imagine a Christian man writing characters which he would not, in fact, endorse or embrace or otherwise, but might work well within the plot. The White Witch is not necessarily a person who embraces one of Lewis's views, for instance. And so Lewis cautions us on trying to make too much of that, and I think that's a good point to keep in mind. Nevertheless, when we look at Lewis's nonfiction, his essays in particular, but also his books and so on, we do know what he believes about many things. For example, in The Hideous Strength, which is fiction, and The Abolition of Man, we know from The Abolition of Man that Lewis is very concerned about talking about correct emotional responses to things and the dangers that come with that. English and a man. And the benefit, though, of the fiction there is that it's not contradicting the abolition of man, but often it poetically enhances or fills out some of the more straightforward philosophy that we get in the abolition of man. Or the same would be true for Perelandra and the problem of pain. The problem of pain, Lewis explains very clearly the situation about, you know, the fall and how this comes to be and what God is doing through pain and suffering and otherwise. And in Perelandra, we get, again, through the voice of the heroes, the deities, or even the hero Ransom, we can see these themes being expressed and developed poetically that help us to appreciate, I think, what Lewis does in the problem of pain even more. I think that there's a complementary nature that we can hook onto, and his fiction complements his nonfiction in important ways and fills it out.
Excellent point. Yeah, a lot of people don't consider that. Some people, fiction is just fiction. It's a nice story, and it's okay to read it at that level, but there can often be more things there than people are generally aware of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, your book, which is just over 600 pages, including the index, first of all, let me note for listeners who aren't familiar, it's not just out this year in 2013 when this is being recorded, but it's been out for several years since 2009. But because it is such a large book, sometimes large books can be kind of hard to navigate or maybe overwhelming. But when you look in the way you've organized it, I think people will be very pleased, and it's structured very well. Can you tell our listeners how you did structure it?
There's two parts to the book. The one is talking about Lewis's philosophical definition, how he defined or understood philosophy, and then talks about also his journey, his philosophical journey, and finally his own identification as a philosopher. And in the part one, there's five different chapters that deal with these definitions. Philosophy as a way of life, sort of the rational aspect, and then another chapter on philosophy as a way of life, and here it's the what I call heavenly desire. It's that Platonic Eros, or Lewis calls it Romanticism, the Sehnsucht, or Numinous, or all these emotive things that Lewis talks about that helps to draw him toward God. Another chapter is on myth, and Lewis is very interesting, very important discussion of myth, and then also the culture that shaped him. That was the first part. The second part are just talking about the major branches of philosophy as a first-order discipline. So there's a chapter purely on Lewis's metaphysics and the major themes in metaphysics and how he develops from his earliest positions to his latest ones. Another chapter on psychology, logic, and epistemology. And then another one, ethics. And there's subcategories along for each of these topics. And then another one on social political philosophy. And then finally on aesthetics. And the idea is within each of these chapters to chronologically see how Lewis develops his views on each of these subjects to sort of appreciate how some of the older stuff is carried forward even into his Christian faith. And to make sense of some of these strange phrases, you know, if we read the letters to Malcolm, Lewis sometimes still refers back to Bradley, or in some of his later letters, Lewis will talk about Berkeley, and he still says, you know, he still was irrefutable. In other words, he couldn't respond still, even as a developed Christian man, to the claims of Berkeley, this early idealist that he is influenced by. And to make sense of those claims, we need to appreciate how he develops chronologically, philosophically. And I think the book will help us to appreciate that much more.
Well, that's an excellent overview of your entire book. I wonder if you could take a few moments to maybe share one of the chapters in your first part about Lewis's philosophical journey.
I'll take chapter two as an example. This is Lewis's rational discourse and training. Now, again, we start out with some claims that Lewis makes about his conversion to Christianity. He says in at least three different places was almost a purely philosophical one. Right? And for Lewis, that meant a rational one. So I start with Lewis's early claims about being a young Christian and how he moves beyond that. And I try to show that his conversion out of Christianity is, in fact, rationally motivated. Christianity was not something that made sense to him at that time. And his first conversion is to what I call a Lucretian materialist. And the Lucretian is an Epicurean, or one who believes that happiness is pleasure. Materialist refers to metaphysical belief that all things that are in fact, material or matter. And perfectly attractive, and he converts at the age of 13 to that. And again, I'm piecing together not just Lewis's own later accounts of his own conversion, which are in fact not as accurate sometimes as what he actually believed at the time, but going back to some of his unpublished works at the Wade Center and other places, there's an interesting essay that Lewis wrote called "Are Athletes Better Than Scholars?" In this, he articulates some of his claims against these boorish jocks who have no appreciation for metaphysics, as this 13-year-old Lewis. So we can see Lewis is concerned, even at early age, with trying to be quite philosophical. And he moves beyond this. His book at the time is the Lucretius's On the Nature of Things, which is certainly a very good book. And Lewis works through that phase for a while. And eventually he starts training with Kirkpatrick. And at this time, Lewis is still a Lucretian materialist. But when he moves to go to the First World War, at that time he enters into a new phase, what I call a pseudo-Manichaean dualist phase. And this is one that Lewis himself doesn't describe in Surprise by Joy or other places, Pilgrim's Regress, but is a very real philosophical phase that he goes through. And in fact, in his letters and in his unpublished sources, he makes a lot of this phase. And I think it's one of the important contributions I make to some of Lewis' studies here, is to develop a little bit of what this phase looks like. This idea of dualism, of there being a good and a bad. And for Lewis, it was spirit and matter. And so Lewis is obviously believing in some sort of spirit thing at this point. So he's not a pure materialist anymore. And he talks about matter variously as in Norse mythology as the frost giant. He also called Satan in other places. And so it's quite an interesting phase. As he leaves the war and the sort of black and whiteness of the war, which obviously influenced him as well, he goes to Oxford, and there he converts to a type of materialism again. This time it's a more, like he calls it, a more manly type of materialism. It's a stoical materialism. And at this time, this is his third phase then, this is 19 to 1923 about, he now starts to recognize that spirit maybe is, well, is it a real thing or not? Kind of goes back a little bit. The Stoics are famous for being materialists, and yet they also spoke about the gods, and they spoke about Zeus, and they spoke about natural law. And so they were very philosophically inconsistent. And that's exactly what we see here with Lewis. He talks about spirit in some places as coming out of this sort of pseudo-Manichaean dualist phase. And yet, on the other hand, he's got this sort of sense of materialism that wants to deny that. And reading some of his unpublished stuff especially is quite intriguing on how he deals with this. He wrote a paper that won the Chancellor's English Essay Prize called Optimism, and in this he talks about the difficulty of God or no God, and it's quite an interesting essay that he writes. As he works through that, he's influenced by Oxford philosophy, which is idealist at the time. Idealism refers to the belief generally that everything that is or exists is idea or spirit. So he starts to move toward an idealist phase. I try to separate that within his idealist phase, and Lewis himself doesn't really identify this, he fluctuates between what's called the subjective idealist, one that would be sort of influenced by someone like Berkeley, who believes that God is a spirit and humans are spirits and we're independent of God in some measure, and yet we're all connected as spirit, and the material world is an illusion. And he fluctuates between that and also an absolute idealist phase, which he calls later on pantheist, or pantheistic idealist phase, which says that we exist only as ideas in the mind of God. And he moves between these two in sort of an unclear, uneasy tension. And again, Lewis is working through his beliefs, and we should expect that this would not be always as clear as we'd like. It's at this time that he's also teaching philosophy at Oxford. And he appropriates the idealists, especially Berkeley, to help make sense of some of this that he teaches. As he moves out of the absolute idealist phase, he moves slowly toward theism. And some of the things that moved him toward theism was, of course, some of the philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, who themselves aren't necessarily theists, but who have been easily appropriated by theists, especially Christian theists. And as he's entering the theist phase, he's also reading much more literature. He's now, in fact, reading literature at Oxford in quite a serious and important way. And he's being exposed to all these great literary texts which have imbibed theism, and especially Christian theism. And so in many places, Lewis is now reading and talking about the works of, for example, Dante. And he talks about Dante as being almost like a spiritual exercise for him. And theism starts to make that much more sense to him as he moves into this phase. And then finally, from there, he moves toward a more clear Christian theism. And the type of Christian theism that he embraces is a rationalist one, so it's a Neoplatonic type of theism. And his major figures in that phase, or coming into that phase, Plato and Aristotle, of course, but the Christians would be Boethius, Augustine, and Dante, and then later on Hooker, for example.
And all that background, I think, helps explain, you know, some people may wonder, but not, you know, search for an answer as to, you know, why it took, you know, about 2 years for him to go from theism to Christianity. But if we see how many things he went through, it's not as surprising that it took some time.
Absolutely. This is not a St. Paul conversion on the road to Damascus. This is a lifetime of struggle. And, you know, even as a Christian, he does develop his ideas still, but less so than we see in the early stages.
Well, now, taking a step back, tell us about your own journey of discovering the writings of C.S. Lewis, and what were some of the first few books that you read?
Well, you know, it's interesting when I reflect upon my own journey. I read the Chronicles of Narnia first, obviously, as a kid. But interestingly, I didn't really like them. There was nothing in them that particularly attracted me to them. There's no foreshadowing that this is inevitably going to be a man that I would want to study and pursue in any deep way. I went to a Christian high school, and there I read The Hideous Strength, and I think it was grade 11 or 12 or one of those, and again, it made no impact. The major impact came for me was that there was a high school teacher, and I actually dedicate this book to him, who was a man who loved C.S. Lewis and was a passionate Christian man and deep thinker. And when I went to university, I took a class, an introductory to philosophy class, and there we read Plato's Republic and Nietzsche's Antichrist. And the idea was to set up this this sort of polemic between these two authors. And I found myself quite naively swinging at all of them, not knowing exactly how my Christianity fit into any of this, and trying to throw the Bible at all of it as a desperate means to kind of articulate myself. And, you know, I didn't do very well at the first half of that class. And so I returned to this teacher, and he suggested some C.S. Lewis and others. And getting into Lewis was incredibly rewarding at that stage, especially because he helped me to see how we could appropriate the good in all philosophers, and some philosophers have more good than others. And so, you know, I returned back to Plato's Republic, which we were reading there, with fresh eyes, you know, with Lewis's blessing in some ways, that it's okay. There's going to be good ideas in here that we need to look at. And that class ended up very well. After that, I continued to read more of Lewis and, you know, became quite addicted to his writings to the point where, and you know, if you meet other fellow Lewis scholars, there's a few of them out there that I can name by name, but, you know, we're the type of person that if we see any marginalia by Lewis, we get very excited. You know, a bubblegum wrapper with something Lewis wrote on, that's news for celebration for us. So that's kind of where I got to the point of enjoying Lewis. But there's always still, you know, room for critical analysis of some of his ideas.
Now, regarding the works by him, what have been favorite works by him, either historically or more recently?
You know, my favorite works that I return to again and again with Lewis are his collection of essays. There was a terrific book that was published. It's called C.S. Lewis Essay Collection, Other Short Story Pieces, and it really has all of his short essays in it. And that's a book that I return to again and again and again. I'm not sure why I like it better than even his longer books. All of his books have his tone and his personality, which make them all very readable. I can't think of any Lewis book that I don't like. Even Studies in Words is fascinating. But his essays are very succinct. He writes on a variety of topics. And so you can feel in Lewis this sort of Aristotelian vision for man, where, you know, Aristotle is the father of modern logic in some ways, but he's also the father of biology, and he's also the father of literary criticism, for heaven's sakes. And, you know, we call it the Renaissance man later on. But Lewis is, in fact, one of these Renaissance men. He's a man who wrote about as many topics as he read about, and he read about nearly everything. And so I find reading his essays to be this celebration of breadth that we don't often get in philosophy, at least. There's often a narrowness that prevents half of you from developing, maybe, as we'd like. So the essays would be the ones I return to the most. But I've taught in various classes books I enjoyed well. Mere Christianity I still find to be a tremendously important book. Most of my debates with atheists, I use the format he does there. Screwtape Letters is terrific. I love his stuff, especially about humor, which I think is undeveloped by Christian philosophers. And so there's a lot of original things in Lewis, but it's quite scattered. Everything you read is going to reward.
Now, though, much of what you've shared today, even just a few moments ago, kind of addresses this question. I wonder, though, if you can maybe, Reese, summarize your thoughts about why Lewis is still making an impact today. Why is he still read?
Lewis is one of those rare men. It's not that he was most philosophically trained, not that he made the best distinctions. If you want a philosopher who works through distinctions in more precise ways, you might read an Alvin Plantinga or a William Lane Craig or otherwise. It's not that he is the greatest poet or a poetic voice. There are greater men than he. But again, this is a fairly unoriginal idea. Lewis brings these together in a way that makes his philosophical writing, and virtually everything he writes has a philosophical tone to it, even Narnia. It makes it so accessible. It's so delightful, and it's delightful instruction. And I think that modern readers can still pick this up. You know, there's a certain extent that, you know, I have some of these students coming up who can't access some of Lewis's language, but Lewis is still fairly accessible as a popular writer, even after having been dead for 50 years now. And I think his beautiful combination of rhetoric and logic make him a huge impact. I also think there's something very refreshing about a man who rationally defends the supernatural and the mythical that makes him well-loved.
Now, before I let you go, what final thoughts would you have for the listeners here about why your book would be something they should consider reading?
I wrote the book. This is a labor in love, really. My sense of writing this book was deeply purposed. Most of the stuff that's written about Lewis, I've found, and I have most of these books on my shelf, to be fairly superficial in some measure. They reiterate simply what Lewis writes in some of his most basic books. And I've always found that Lewis says things much better than Lewis scholars say about Lewis. And so after a certain point, I find most of them not to be worth buying. My own work was to get at the chronology of Lewis as he develops, especially his philosophical development, in order to understand his theological project, his apologetical project, even his way of doing literature. I think understanding his early philosophical influence as well, and not a lot of people do. For example, his Great War Debate. It's a very obscure text. Few people understand it. Few people have explained it clearly or well. And I think part of the thing that I do in this book that I think is effective is unpacking some of these unpublished stuff, some of these more obscure things, trying to clarify this, show how early ideas have moved forward and carried forward even to his last days. And so that chronological breadth of his philosophical development, I think, is unique and still is unique even 5 years after the book has been out. And also going into depth on some of the major philosophical branches that he deals with, metaphysics, epistemology. Lots of authors talk about some of the aspects of epistemology, or some aspects of metaphysics, and the chronology is rarely clarified, and certainly the depth of understanding, idealist metaphysics, for example, or materialist metaphysics, are not there. Most people who have written on Lewis have not, in fact, been philosophically trained. And so won't get at what Lewis is getting at, and therefore won't appreciate Lewis as he ought to.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Adam Barkman. He's the author of C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life. And let me read the subtitle. It's a comprehensive historical examination of his philosophical thoughts that came out in 2009. Thanks for being with me, Adam.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I'm William O'Flaherty. Thanks for joining me today to hear my conversation with Dr. Adam Barkman about his book, C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life. This interview was initially released in 2013, the year that marked the 50th anniversary of the death of C.S. Lewis, which is why I had Adam share some more general reflective questions about Lewis, in addition to details about his book, which came out in 2009. When you visit the show notes, you'll find a direct link to buy the book online. Plus, I have links to Dr. Barkman's faculty page and a short free online article by him entitled Lewis the Young Philosopher, 1917 to 1919. You can get to the show notes by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com, which is the location where the audio files are hosted. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to the podcast. Plus, I have a variety of articles there as well, including a series examining quotations alleged to be from C.S. Lewis that might not be. Additionally, I also share a daily fact, quote, and quiz at EssentialCSLewis.com. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. Recent ones include my chat with Stephen Elmore from the C.S. Lewis Foundation about their 2015 fall retreat, but because they have events each year, you'll want to still listen to that show even if the event has passed. Then not long ago, I also shared a conversation about a book by Dr. Diana Glier called Bandersnatch that is releasing by December 2015. That was a recording done back in March, but only recently posted. Older episodes to consider listening to are a roundtable discussion I had about The Hobbit, the book versus the movies. It was a two-part show with Dr. Charlie Starr, Dr. Crystal Hurd, and Britton Dickinson. Another show to consider is a special podcast of a talk I did in 2014 about C.S. Lewis as preacher 75 years later. Again, you can hear those and others by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help make sure this podcast is freely available to all? Consider becoming a financial supporter of this podcast to make sure it continues. There's a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as a dollar a month. There are some great rewards possible, and no long-term commitments is necessary.